Okay, so I'm having a hot flash. Doesn't take much. Nancy, thank you so much. You know, you inspire me. So, yeah, I got to put my hair up because I'm definitely sweating up here. I am a very grateful member of the Essanon International Family Groups, and my name is Robin M. And I am so honored to be here with you. It's such a blessing that I'm still here. And I'm a little nervous. Actually, what I've written is I'm incredibly nervous. And I did write my talk because I tend to leave my body. And I'd like to really be here, right now. So I'll sort of half read, half share. I wanted to say that these are my opinions only. I don't speak for Essanon, and I don't represent Essanon. This is purely about my experience, strength, and hope. I'm aware that this meeting is being taped, and I want to acknowledge those people that are listening to this CD in the future, and I want to say to you, welcome. I'm glad you're here. Also, I want to say to the newcomers, I need you. We need you. You keep this program green for me. I heard someone say in a meeting recently, we don't care why you're here. And it doesn't matter what got you through the door. What matters is that you are here. And we're so happy that you are. Please keep coming back. I am powerless over sexaholism and the sexaholic, and when I try to control, manage, or manipulate those things I am powerless over, my life becomes unmanageable. I cannot imagine what life was like for those people, for our founders, before there was Essanon. I can't even conceivably think how they got through the days. How fortunate I was that when I was ready, the messengers were there waiting for me. If you are in this room and you're a lone member, if you're listening to this tape and you're a lone member, I have a question for you. Why haven't you started a meeting? What's stopping you? We have literature and lots of people that are willing to walk you through this. What a beautiful gift that would be for your community and for the Worldwide Fellowship. And to further illustrate that, I wanted to tell you that I spoke with Jerry P. She was one of our founders. I spoke with her last week. And she's not traveling like she used to, so she's not here with us today. I asked her if there was something that she might like for me to share with you all, and we talked about what it was like before there was a meeting for her to go to, and then what it was like when she finally was able to sit face-to-face with someone. And here's what she said to me. I was so grateful to finally find people to be with me because I was so lonely. Fortunately, I had another program, a sponsor, and other people in place, but it wasn't the same. There is nothing like talking with people that understand what it's like having been affected by sexaholism. And then she shared a reading with me, one of Bill W.'s, and I brought it down to one sentence. It's out of The Language of the Heart, which is a conference-approved Essanon literature. He wrote, I feel that my pain has in part been occasioned by others. I love the way he writes, occasioned by others. I try to repeat, God, grant me the serenity to love their best and never fear their worst. This was one of her favorite readings. When Jerry was first told of her spouse's sexaholism, his illness, they were married 32 years. They'll be married 60 years, their next anniversary. She keeps coming back, and that inspires me. So here is a condensed version of my Essanon recovery, and boy, is it just a snippet. This is my process around loving a sexaholic. I'm no expert, but I have learned an awful lot over the last 22 years of my Ethanon recovery from my higher power and as a result of a very slow but consistent study of what happened, what I was like, and how I came to this point in my life today. The work has been through the steps, traditions, being of service, my sponsors, listening to those Ethanons that have taught me so much about loving others and loving the sexaholics. I was born in Philadelphia, PA in 1950. I'm going to be 59 any minute. I am the younger of two sibs. I was molested several times at an early age, which completely changed the way I view the world. When I was about seven, my family moved down to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I was raised. I was a very poor student. I had a very difficult time concentrating and resorted to cheating and stealing to get through school. I am dyslexic. I was not diagnosed until my 40s, until I was in recovery. And I have always been attracted to unusual and challenged human beings. I'm glad somebody else here relates. The first time I married, I was 18. It was a shotgun wedding and a violent marriage. I was 19 years old, 1 month, when I gave birth to the most beautiful baby girl, bright, wondrous. Little did I know that she was an alcoholic addict. We divorced when she was five. I pushed so far away from my relationship in order to save it that I lost my ability to love this human being, and worse, to love myself. I've moved about 39 times, most of which was based on the insanity of my own making. Six were cross-country moves, only one of them in recovery. Five were in two of my hippie vans. I was consistently chasing after an illusion, a feeling. I was involved with quite a few men prior to my marriage to Terry. That's my husband, Terry. I believe that they were all addicts, some sexaholics. I am attracted to compulsive, addictive personalities. Most of my girlfriends were icks of some kind. And as I look at my inventory around these relationships, I see that each laid yet another layer to an already unhealthy worldview. My kid was a runaway. I had her arrested and saw her handcuffed, driven away in a police car when she was 14. Addiction is ruthless. And it doesn't care how old or how young a person is. Before she got sober, she spent time in a boarding school, adolescent psychiatric hospital, an orphanage, and eventually living on the streets in a flea-bitten bush behind a church. She got sober at 16 by the grace of her higher power. I tried everything I could to fix her personality. I did not understand the addiction process then. It is my opinion that the true victims are our children. Perhaps the most tragic part of my story is that I was both verbally and physically abusive to her. And the way I dealt with this was by numbing out with my own addictions. I crossed the line from victim to victimizer. I was single about 9 years when along came Terry, and I have a little heart next to his name. That's how I feel today. Then, I don't know. We married March of 1983. This truly started my bottoming out process in fast forward motion because, you know, living alone, I could cover up a lot of problems. Now I was married and I was helping to raise two of his two stepsons. This is getting in my way. Because I didn't understand the addiction process, I just continued to do what I had always done. I spent countless, endless days doing things that enabled me to keep 1 foot out the door and wasted days and energy trying to keep both of his feet in the door. I was constantly in fear of losing my marriage and fretting over why in the world I should stay. How could I love this person? How could this be love? As you all know, living with active sexaholism is heartbreaking and devastating. Perhaps some of you lived the way I did, confused because one day there was calm in the home and the next day upheaval. I felt crazy. I didn't know about sexaholism at the time, and I didn't know that the disease doesn't care about me. I just thought that the sexaholic didn't care about me. It's a common perception. The effects of living with active or untreated sexaholism can destroy families, it takes hostages, it leaves scars on our children, it can kill the person that doesn't have it. There are countless unrecovered Essenons in the penal system with no meetings that I know of. In Terry's words, and I asked him if he would give me a sentence to describe how he felt about himself. This is what he said to me. I thought I was the lowest piece of dung on earth, and then I would sink lower. Before Essenon, of course, I felt despair. I didn't have a snowball's chance in you-know-what to fix his personality. I didn't know what I was up against. Essenon gave me tools and something to think about other than my fear. You gave me the three C's. I can't cure it, I can't control it, and I didn't cause it. In the second year of our marriage, there were three of us bottoming out in the same house. It was lovely. What started this eruption was my daughter hitting her bottom around her drug and alcoholism. So, and she went right into recovery. At the end of her first month of sobriety, she moved out of her house and moved in with her sponsor. She probably ran, she ran out of the house. Terry and I were faced with one another without the distraction of her disease. I was horrified. I actually called my kid's sponsor. Some of you have heard me tell you this story. It's a true story. I called her sponsor to find out what they were talking about. He says, our disease is funny, isn't it? I didn't see anything funny, but it's true. I was afraid she was giving away the family secrets. Shortly after, I started my first 12-step program. By the following year, I was attending Essenon meetings regularly. I'm not one of those that can stand in front of you today that can tell you that things got better right away, because quite frankly, it was hell. I did not believe I would live to see 50. My only hope was the steps, and I clung tight and went in head first. By the time I made it to my first 12-step program, I was fantasizing suicide. I was shoplifting. Somebody owed me something. I was going to get it from somewhere. I was smoking dope almost daily, smoking and drinking. Well, you would, too, if you were living, with the people I was living with. And I was, once again, in tremendous fear that I had, once again, made a stupid mistake in my choice of mates. It takes time for the wreckage of our past to unravel and shake loose. 12-step programs are not a quick fix. We all have something profound in common. All of us know what it is to find ourselves in desperate situations, and there is good news. There is great hope in this program and the possibilities of miracles. Our ability to give and receive love will expand tremendously. It's in our gifts. Terry didn't tell me right away that he was going to SA. He just said this was a new program no one had ever heard of. And jokingly, I told a girlfriend, it's probably Infidelity Anonymous. Eight months later, on a Friday night, he disclosed his joy. He disclosed his joy of having found Sexaholics Anonymous. That Saturday night, I walked into the West LA, Los Angeles meeting, and that was November 1st, 1986. And believe me, I didn't have love on my mind. It was more like frustration. Here's my list. Frustration, insecure, I was scared, and I had deep-seated anger and shame. However, I did feel some relief because it was the first time I ever remember hearing Terry say that he had a problem. I always thought it was my, I was doing something. It was all about me. You know, here's Robin, here's the universe. And I actually felt a little giddy because of that. Over the many years I've been coming into Asinine, I've heard stories of how many of us have come into this program wondering why our love alone could not cure the ills of our loved ones. Personally, I was desperate to hear that I was right and he was wrong. So although I wasn't thinking about love, something worse was going on with me. I had been experiencing indifference. Some of us arrived at the doorpost having hit rock bottom in our Esalen disease by avoiding our intuition, literally ignoring our truth by turning a blind eye to what we frantically searched for and found. I came in, I had been begging, I borrowed, I stole, I cajoled, I controlled, and I snooped and eavesdropped, hoping to hear something that would tell me that I was okay. I did not realize the gift of having started in another recovery program. I just thought I knew it all. And so when I came into Esalen, you know, I could tell everybody what they should be doing because this is not how you conduct a meeting. You know, and that didn't last long because you know what hit the fan. but I did have another program, and I do think it was beneficial. For one thing, I was part of a huge worldwide fellowship. There was hundreds of meetings in L.A. that I could go to, and there was a huge group of people I could choose from to be a sponsor. We still don't have that in Esalen. And I had a sponsor, and I was working with her for about 8 or 9 months, and something very interesting happened, as it always does in this program. My sponsor understood sexaholism. She told me, amazingly, my higher power had chosen for me a sponsor whom in her first marriage had lived with the profound effects of sexaholism to the point of despair. Her path took her on a quest to find help. She found herself in what she characterized as a very strange meeting in Simi Valley. That's Simi Valley, California. There was no such thing as Esalen. She never went back and consequently left that marriage. By working the Esalen program, I've experienced what I call a paradigm adjustments that have led to many spiritual awakenings. One of the more profound adjustments is something some of you have heard me say for many years. Although my awareness deepens, the longer I meditate on it, the effect is still as profound as when I first got it. This information came to me in two parts at different times. The first part was passed on to me by that sponsor. Robin, it's okay for you to love a sexaholic. I am inspired by these words even today. I consider this to be a spiritual concept rooted in my step work and homegrown through my study of the traditions. This is an understanding. It's an agreement I have with my higher power that has come to me in dreams and whispers and loud resolve. It is reflected through my life experiences and ultimately by my ability to experience the joy of being able to love freely. I do not have to be ashamed to love a sexaholic. When I first came into the program, I was under the illusion that what another person did, their choices, was a reflection on me. I took everything personally, which meant I was responsible, and therefore I had to do something to change whatever it was that was uncomfortable to me, even if it wasn't any of my business. I didn't know that I could hate the disease and love the person. For me, it had been either or. And by the way, I know this doesn't mean that I have to stay in the marriage or the relationship just because I love the person. It simply means that I do not have to go so far away from my higher power and my truth that I cut off that part of myself that is the best part of who I am, a person that can love and still take good care of myself. Once I was able to let go of the idea that to love the sexaholic in my life meant that I had to give up my self-worth and my dignity, the second part came to me. It's okay to be loved by a sexaholic. To do this does not mean that I am stupid or silly or naive. It does not mean that I am settling, putting up with, or engaging in something evil or unhealthy. It is simply being open to what has become the greatest opportunity I have ever been given in recovery, to remember and reclaim what I came into this world knowing, and for one reason or another I lost, that I am worthwhile and lovable, and that I can share this with another human being in a healthy way. Gifts come in many different packages for us in recovery. For some, it means that relationships must end, and for others, they begin. For Terry and me, our relationship has endured and continues to flourish. We celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary in March of July, 2008. Terry adopted my daughter at age 39, legal adoption. This was a testimony to this recovery and to love. I'm so happy that I can never said this publicly, so this is a first. And I'm actually happy to be able to share this with you. And this is just for today, by the way. I have a good marriage. Or it's not perfect, but I have a good marriage. And I'm crazy about him. You know what? I love Terry. I'm in love with him. I have respect for him. And most of the time, I'm open to learning what he has to teach me today about his perspectives on life, how he loves, and NASCAR. You know what? That's a lie. He took me in a NASCAR. I fell asleep. I packed my tofu hot dogs. He said, "You're the only person in the history of NASCAR that has eaten tofu and it falls asleep." But I did. But you know what? I'm happy for him. He likes it. I don't mean that to offend anybody, but just so you know, we have very heated discussions. I don't want to. And I know you know this, but somehow I need to just tell you that this is not a storybook marriage because, you know, my idea of what a storybook marriage is, I don't think exists. So to keep this in perspective, we get into it pretty good. The true gift here for me, this is what I wrote, the true gift here for me has been the ability to participate in a long-term, relationship in which I can try out the ups and downs of my Essanon recovery with the same person. The most obvious way to describe to you, to show you the impact this program has had on me, particularly in those early days, is what you see right here, right now. I am here. You saved my life and are so important to my health and well-being today. My Essanon recovery continues to be a profound commitment that I make every day because as much as I mess up and step on other people's toes, I would rather work the steps and admit when I'm wrong than to go back to the way I used to live. I have changed greatly. My ability to allow myself to love and feel loved, to be part of a process, is part of my process of healing today. I am constantly being adjusted back to my truth. I noticed some years back that for no particular reason, I would be overwhelmed with feelings of joy and love when I would think about Terry. However, I would keep them to myself. I don't know if any of you can relate to that, but I would hoard those awesome feelings, much like I used to hoard money and marijuana. I would hold out of fear that there would never be enough, or that I wouldn't, it wouldn't be there when I needed it. And I think that actually at times I held out in exchange for what I needed or what I thought I needed. Why would I keep this from Terry? You know, why would I keep that from him? What was the risk? Would this somehow give my power away to him? Because love is rooted in my connection with my higher power, not in my confidence in Terry and his higher power. Yes, I believe that that to be on the receiving end of someone's feelings of love and actions is a gift, something to cherish and appreciate. But it doesn't mean that I have to give away all of who I am as a human being. Bill W. said, "Brimming with gratitude, one's heartbeat must surely result in outgoing love, the finest emotion that we can ever know." Today, when I have these feelings, I stop whatever I am doing, and I call Terry or my daughter, whomever, because I held out on everybody, not just Terry. I have nothing to lose today. This is the outcome of practicing this program, which, by the way, includes making mistakes constantly. I assure you, I do not always come from a loving place 100% of the time. I'm simply much more open and therefore more available to have an open heart. How odd it would be for me today to turn down my higher power's gift of knowing that love exists and it exists inside of me. And then equally, how odd for me to not give this precious gift away. I am a work in process. And I want to close with a reading from Lois Wilson. It's from her memoirs. I consider her a great, 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 great grandmother. Bill's recovery came about in spite of me. Although it was what I had been working for all my life, I had gone about it the wrong way. My love, as deep as it was also possessive, and my ego was so great, I felt I could change him into what I thought he ought to be. The big lesson I have learned is that we cannot change another human being. Only ourselves. By living our own lives to the best of our ability, by loving deeply and not trying to mold another to our wishes, we can help not only ourselves, but others as well. Thank you so much and enjoy the rest of the convention.
Take an extra stretch if you need to. My name is Gene Johnson. I'm a Grateful Essanon from Oklahoma City. I like that by Gene. I've always liked to hear that come back. And I have a distinct pleasure today of making an introduction, and you're going to have a pleasure of having a double whammy of Essanons. And just so that they might erase any misconceptions, Essanon is has no restrictions. We do race, color, creed, or sex. And so they are some of us that have been around the Essanon program for a while, but that's not what I'm here to do. My chore is to introduce to you a fellow Essanon member who is from San Diego, California. He has been in the Essanon program, an active member of the Essanon program for over 12 years. He's been in service to the World Service Organization of Essanon for over 7 years, and he is an active member of his home group in San Diego as an Essanon. And I'm sure you will be as delighted as I am to hear Norman's story, and I give you Norman from San Diego.
Thanks, Jane, for your kind words. The theme of this convention is we absolutely insist on enjoying life. But hey, I knew how to enjoy life before I came in the program. It took a long string of addicts, but addicts can be fun. They like to party. They love excitement and thrills. They let me join them. I even thought it was a good idea to marry an addict. I optimistically thought it was a good idea. What can I say? I'm an optimist. Of course, the optimism always faded. The honeymoon, sooner or later, would end. And the reason, as they saw it, was me. My concern for carrying out responsibilities bored them. Paying bills on time, getting the children to bed at a reasonable hour, going to work every day, was not spontaneous enough for them. It was then that my life before the program became unenjoyable. I even wondered if maybe I was boring. The type of person that I've been attracted to all my life, the abandoned ones, began early and has not changed. It began with my very first teenage crush on the girl next door. She had been abandoned by her parents and left with her grandparents. She said that her father had been mean to her mother, and that as soon as her mother found a job, she would take her back. That was not true. I don't know what the truth was, because it was a family with secrets. The reality was, she was there for over a year. I had fallen in love with my first abandoned one. And abandonment became the underlying theme of my relationships. So how did I get set on this course in life? Well, a lot had to do with early childhood experiences. And my childhood was fairly ordinary. There was one difference. My home was a rather subdued place where emotions were not expressed or expressed poorly. My parents always held everything in. My mother did not learn to express emotions from her parents. Her parents' marriage was an arranged one. And there was no affection there. I recall as a child overhearing an aunt say about her parents that they appeared to have nothing between them, yet they had 8 children. My mother was very insecure and intensely shy. My father was inept at emotions too. He was first generation, born in this country, of Norwegian stock. Norway is the land of the stiff upper lip and land of the reserved. He also had a macho attitude, no timidity, no tears, no weakness allowed. This set up a contradiction for me. From my mother, who was much more influential on me, I learned that there was a lot out in the world that I should be afraid of. And from my father, who stayed away from the family as much as he could, I learned that I had better not. This was a contradiction that I couldn't reconcile, and it always left me feeling less than. At age 19, I met the woman that I would marry. She, like the ones who would follow, was intelligent, a high achiever, attractive, and abandoned. A man raised her, helped raise her. He pretended to be her father. Actually, he hated her because she was not his. This poor girl did everything she could think of to win the love of this man and couldn't understand what she had done wrong, because this was a family with secrets. I took her out of that home, and I became her next emotionally unavailable man. After a year, the second theme of my relationships emerged: betrayal. That betrayal ended the marriage, and I moved on to my next abandoned one. Her father deserted the family when she was 10, never to return, never to make contact, never to pay child support. Her mother worked three jobs to support the family, and she basically raised herself from age 10. This too was a family with secrets. She uncovered one of the secrets going through an old trunk that her father had left behind. In it, she found abortion tools. Now, this marriage lasted for years, not because I was happy particularly, but because we had two children. I put up with a lot, but betrayal was the final straw. I broke up with her. I took her back. She cheated on me. I broke up with her. I took her back. She cheated on me. This cycle repeated itself for a year and a half. It was by far the darkest period of my entire life. I literally hated myself for being so indecisive and spineless. I had become all the things that my father had taught me to despise. The marriage finally ended, and I moved on to my next, eventually, to my next major relationship, my next abandoned one. She had been abandoned by both parents at times, but mostly by her father. No, not her father, a man who claimed to be the father, who deep down hated her for the same reason my first wife's father was so hateful. She was not let in on the secret, and she has spent her life trying to prove her worth. Now, I imagine that a child raised by a man who claims to be the father, who isn't the father, who puts up an act and fails and really hates the child, just loathes the child, is probably a small example of family structure. Not small enough. I found a married two there. Now, this marriage was blissfully happy. After all, I had to be much more careful in my choice of partner. I didn't want to repeat the mistakes I had made in the past. I can't explain why her rather unique family of origin did not register as important. 10 years into the marriage, I was injured on the job. And I was home. And I guess because I was home, I was a little more observant. And I began to feel that there was something wrong between us. I couldn't put my finger on it. But the feeling grew and grew. And I found myself going through her stuff. Her drawers, her mail, her wallet. I became a good Essanon spy. One day, when she drove up the drive, I peeked out the window and saw that she locked her briefcase in the trunk of her car. When it was safe, I went out and opened a briefcase and found letters from another man. Not love letters, lust letters. Well, remembering the difficulty I had had breaking up with my previous wife, I broke up with her on the spot. Well, almost. After a couple of weeks, I softened and suggested we go to marriage counseling. At the first session of marriage counseling, when it was my turn to speak, I went on the attack. And I told the therapist what a rotten person she was, how unjustly I had been treated, and what a slut she had been. The therapist replied, "Water seeks its own level." Well, that was news to me. Up until that very moment, I was not the one with the problem. I, for some strange reason, always just happened to be with the one with the problem. The therapist also said that when a woman has an affair, we've got to look at it closely, and the next session would be with her. At the third session, the very first words out of the therapist's mouth were, "You are married to an addict." Well, the marriage couldn't be saved. In fact, she told me later that, as far as she was concerned, the marriage ended on our wedding day. But it was not a total lost experience. There was one good thing that came out of it. The therapist referred me to Essanon. But good things are not always easy. I couldn't see that I had any problems with boundaries. I denied that I was in denial. Thanks. I had equated spirituality with religion, something that I had rejected probably about age 10, certainly by age 12. But I was with a group of people who really understood the pain that I was in. And they offered me hope, something that I didn't have. I had none. I had no hope. And that was enough to keep me coming back. Now, a big breakthrough for me in my understanding of addiction which is terribly confusing. I mean, why are compulsions so compulsive? Anyway, I came across a document called the Personal Craziness Index. It's a catalog in 10 categories of the chaos that is the addict's life. And yeah, she was in there. She was maxed out in every category. To this very day, I am amazed how the chaotic life we live seemed normal. But equally important, for the very first time, I saw my part in the craziness. I was maxed out too. I was maxed out in endlessly working to make the abnormal seem normal. I threw myself into busyness to compensate for her scatteredness. My thinking was, I'm helping her. The help I was giving her was a sign of my love for her. Her thinking was different. She thought that I was so busy that I had abandoned her. And abandonment is that thing which so closely correlates with addiction. The abandonment she felt depressed her. And although it was only a temporary fix, she only knew one way to make herself feel better, to act out in her own addiction. In other words, my love for her was pushing her into her addiction. It doesn't get any crazier than that. With the help of the 12 Steps of Essanon, I have changed my life. I've even overcome my attraction to the abandoned ones to find a satisfying relationship. It's a long story. They gave me 20 minutes, and I've only got a few minutes left. So I'll save it for another time. But I am much more based in reality. And reality can be enjoyable, long term. I even got my optimism back. My time is about up. I have one more thing to say. One of the reasons that I was asked to speak is because I'm a surfer, and surfers know how to enjoy life. Well, I have incorporated a very important program principle to extend my surfing career: self-care. And self-care is something that we in Essanon emphasize continually. And I've used it to maintain my health. I eat a good diet. I control my weight. I don't want to sink my surfboard. And I go to the gym to stay fit. The program has helped me in so many unexpected ways. And I thank God for Essanon. Thanks for letting me share.
Hello, family. Hi, my name's Debbie. I'm a very grateful member of Essanon. Yeah, and I greet you folks that way because we all came to Essanon or SA because we're all survivors of the same disease. Our lives were devastated by the effects sexaholism had on our lives, whether we're the Essanon or the SA or both. And my life has been profoundly affected in a positive way
by being with all of you convention after convention and by working my own personal recovery program over the last 21 years. And I want to speak just for a couple minutes about two important traditions. First of all, our tradition one tells us our common welfare comes first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. Our collective unity, all of us Essenons coming together and doing what's in the best interest of the whole fellowship. Because if the groups and the worldwide fellowship do not survive, there wouldn't be very much individual recovery. And if you're really, my belief is if you're really upholding that first tradition of our common welfare, that you will see the importance in supporting our seventh tradition, which states we're fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And while I finish talking for the next couple minutes, Essenon members have baskets. They're going to come up from the back and toward the front and pass the baskets. For our seventh tradition collection. This is for Essenon family groups. We have produced some wonderful literature, which I'm very proud of over the last several years. And that's our literature is a very visible, tangible thing that you can touch and pick up and read and share. But there's many other areas that we're trying to grow and carry the message with. And we have a couple fairly new committees, our Public Information and Outreach Committee, where we're doing our best to get the word out to potential Essenon members, to professionals, to the worldwide community. And another committee I'm very excited about that is brand new is our Archives Committee, which Robin M. is chairing. And we're at the point, Essenon is almost 25 years old, and we need to get some of our history documented. And we're working on getting a traveling display that will go from, hopefully, from convention to convention, and getting some history written down. And that takes some funds. And we have that in our budget for 2009. And that will happen if the funds come in. And our seven tradition donations, both individual and group, they have been down over the last couple years. So please know, if your group is not contributing on a regular basis to the World Service Office, that's very important, just as important as paying rent or using your funds to purchase literature. Again, our common welfare comes first. We also want to support the growth of ESSA teens. Although there are not any teens registered this weekend, I've been a long-time ESSA teen sponsor, and this is a family disease, and I truly believe in family recovery, and we can do that with your continued seven tradition donations to support family recovery. If you have cash, we accept large bills. Small bills, larger bills are appreciated. If you want to write a check, we take checks, just make it out to Essenon. If you are not exchanging money until tonight or tomorrow morning, that's fine. Find one of us board members with this button on, or come to the literature table and give your contribution to Christy or George. They will take it to the World Service Office. So thank you very, very much.